Off the ball on News Talk.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products.
And you're very welcome along to Sunday's paper review. It's Richie McCormack here with you, and we have a lot to get through this afternoon. So, thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products. We're joined by David Snaides of the Irish Daily Mail, the Irish Daily Mail on Sunday, the football correspondent thereof, and also Noel Kelly, the deputy editor of 42.ie, and ghostwriter for Fighter, Andy Lee's upcoming autobiography. Not content with hoovering up all sports books awards last year, you're back again to wreak havoc upon the award ceremonies of 2018.
With a little bit of luck, yeah.
With a little bit of luck. We'll get to that, and I'll bring you to the headlines first of all. Looking at the Sunday World, Klopp Eye is the headline they've gone with there. Boss reveals fears for Firmino after Liverpool sell the victory Jan Vertonghen, getting familiar with the eye socket of the Brazilian striker there. Back page of the Sunday People Sport, power and the gory Firmino and horror eye injury. Ruthless Reds make it 5 out of 5. Keep your eye on the ball. Firmino horror injury as Klopp tells flying cop stars to stay focused. Another picture from yesterday's 2-1 win at Wembley, and deal to die for. Juve looking for a £150 million exchange with striker Paulo Dybala to bring back Pogba. I can't see that happening somehow. Back page of Sun Sport today. Hazard warning. That's the number of goals Sarri says Eden can net this season. That's 40. He added to that with a hat-trick yesterday, of course. Put a cork in Cork. Obviously focusing on today's All-Ireland Ladies Football Final with Dublin taking on Cork from 4 p.m. And the first appearance so far from our papers of the O'Donovan brothers. Chart hits their gold in the lightweight double skulls yesterday in Plovdiv. Pretty in pink, United's rotten away jersey features, but United stars are humbled by Jose following their plucky underdog victory over Watford yesterday. Eyes on the prize, Rob injury can't stop Klopp's boys. Now we see Vertonghen and Firmino tangling again. Power and the gory, I've already gone with them, the people, Firmino horror eye injury. And on the Sunday Independent Sports, they've gone with a wraparound again this week. Unfinished business, they focus on the ladies' football final meeting of Cork and Dublin. And on the Sunday Times as well, playing a blinder, Roberto Firmino clutching his eye. And we also see a clip of Wayne Rooney at the top there. He features in a couple of today's papers, namely the Times and the Mail on Sunday. And Matt Doherty, my face doesn't fit O'Neill. We'll get to that a little bit later. And finally, giving a full back page, well done to your colleagues here, David. Masterstroke, O'Donovan brothers show their class again with World Championship gold in Bulgaria. And I suppose you have to start with today as well, because not long before we started this little shindig, another goal for Ireland in Plovdiv, namely from Sunita Pospor in the women's singles goals. Fantastic journey from her, and it's played upon a little bit in Dennis Walsh's piece, which was in preview of it, I guess, before today's final, and shows the journey that Pospor has been on from being a kid in Latvia and being pushed through these, I suppose, aptitude courses for rowing. It seems she was made for it, as we've been told in the wake of the Olympics, a lot of Irish people are. But back in Latvia, Sunita Pospor was definitely made for rowing, it seems. Though.
Yeah, it's a really, I guess, in context it's of what we know has happened in the last couple of hours, it's a really interesting read, because Sunita has been a recognisable name in Irish sport for the last few years, certainly in advance of the 2016 Olympics in Rio. But there are a lot of details in this that I think a lot of people might be coming to fresh for the first time, and I think in the context now of a world champion and someone who will obviously have high hopes to go on and be an Olympic medalist in Tokyo in 2 years' time, I think there's some really interesting insights, for example, about how Sunita started off, how she began her career, as you said, in Latvia, and she was identified, she was kind of picked up by some talent identification programs which helped nurture this talent, but then how
she had no background, but that's the thing, she had no background in rowing, she had no interest in rowing. Mm-hmm. It was like, you're tall and rangy, you will definitely make a good rower.
Or maybe that's the way to do it. Like, we see a lot of it in talent transfer programs here now. We've seen it kind of with the Women's Rugby Sevens program, yeah. We see it with women's cycling as well, with track cycling.
That we'll see it with the AFL as well, and how they approach Gaelic footballers and Gaelic athletes in general, thinking that you have everything in your makeup to actually, you know, prosper at this sport.
And that's it. And I guess it goes back to a conversation that we have over and over again about not forcing your kids to specialise in one sport at a young age, that the more attributes they can develop over as wide a range of sports as possible, the better it is in the long term. But I guess for Sunita, the interesting thing is then you think now she's 36 years old, I think now, and you think, okay, so she was picked up at this by this identification programme it's been far from a steady progression from there to here.
Now, as Dennis mentions, it's been a zigzag throughout the course, but she was, plucked at 15 or mid-teens. She was sent to a boarding school 15 miles from Riga, where the process intensified. There were 10 training sessions a week, mornings and evenings, with lessons and tiredness in between. From there on, she goes to work as a police officer. She doubles up working in a hotel to try and pay her way as well. In 2006, she married her husband, Kaspars. Then they come to Ireland. And then from there on, Kaspars loses his job. They're pretty much talking about there being no food in the fridge. Mm. And she has to go back to rowing. And it's not necessarily as a means of putting food on the table. It's just because she has to scratch that competitive itch. And it's a testament to her as an athlete, I guess.
So it was one of them, as you mentioned, it's sort of like a preview to the race. But it does, you can still pick it up later on today. And it's still going to be a fascinating read. Even more so the fact that with the success as well.
By weird dint of happenstance, I find it works better now.
Yeah.
Because if you read this, and you kind of go, oh wow, she's putting in a lot of background tools, and she goes and performs brilliantly, then you're like, the piece almost gets forgotten about. What this does now is most people will pick up the paper after seeing her win gold today and read her background, and I think it will almost add to the victory for her today in people's eyes.
You can see there even just like the strength of character she must have in terms of, like, there's bits there about kind of how, like, she was in debt, like opening the fridge and, like, there was barely any food there. She's trying to be an athlete, like working double jobs. It's a tremendous piece, and it's one that people should be reading later on today.
Yeah, I mean, myself and yourself now were out in Rio a couple of years ago, and we saw the disappointment of Paspor and how she performed out there. She ended up finding herself in the C-final, and to have worked back, she's tailored her schedule to a degree to work towards this World Championship goal this year, and it paid off in spades.
And peaked at absolutely the right time. Like, I don't want to say that there was any sense of, it's easy to say in hindsight, I don't want to say there was any sense of inevitability that she would put in the performance that she put in this morning. But she's been electric all week, and she must have known this morning that she was in essentially the form of her career, getting ready to challenge for a world goal, and it's an absolute brilliant thing to see that she delivered on that stage, and it will give her every hope of going back to what'll be a third Olympic Games now in Tokyo and competing for a medal.
You imagine as well, like, the feelings she must have now, kind of go through what she's been through and everything like that, and kind of just kind of sacrifices she's made and everything. It's all been worthwhile. Like, I know she probably wouldn't have had regrets anyway, kind of fighting for the career she's had, but now that she has this success, and obviously that they're still in the Olympics, but, like, it must just be a tremendous feeling for her to have that now, of that, just that accomplishment, and maybe not so much a weight off her shoulders, but just must be a great sense of kind of...
You imagine it would be. It just doubles up on the confidence you would have heading into the next cycle, which will obviously be for Tokyo in 2020. And again, over the course of the next 18 months, 2 years, what we're going to be looking at and hearing about is a lot of stories about funding and whether or not certain bodies and national governing bodies are adequately funded. Piece that's in the news section of the Sunday Times today from Colin Coyle, saying both Rowing Ireland and Sailing Ireland have received less capital funding than they requested ahead of the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. Again, one of these pieces that once you read it in retrospect to what the O'Donovans and what Paspor have done over the course of this weekend, it just makes your eyes pop. Even though Ireland's only medals at the 2016 Games in Rio were in the two sports. Kind of troubling, apparently they asked Rowing Ireland for $175,000 from the Department of Transport, Tourism and Sport for 6 boats costing $25,000 each and trailers to transport them. The sporting body was initially turned down for the capital funding entirely after failing 2 points short of the minimum 32 in an assessment by department officials. This is bizarre.
It seems absolutely incredible. And it probably, when you read the criteria there that Colin Coyle has outlined, the criteria which they're assessed on, I guess it comes back to a philosophical question about what this money should be doing. Should we be investing in our top athletes to go, the people that we know can go and win medals because they have a track record of going and performing at the top level and succeeding? Should we be investing in them to put them in the best position possible? Or should, you know, is this Department of Transport, Tourism and Sport funding supposed to kind of grow the game and be developing grassroots and different levels? Because when you read the criteria, they downscored rowing on the money wouldn't have an effect on socioeconomic disadvantage, that they're not sharing facilities, and that the association wasn't contributing its own money, and the technical merits of the application. I mean, if you start bringing socioeconomic disadvantage into play here, that suggests to me that you're weighting this towards an overall societal picture rather than developing your, putting your top athletes in a position to go and compete at the top level.
Which isn't without its merits, to be fair. Like, there is a lot to be said for the forward planning that would be involved. But surely if you are looking for capital funding, then you need to also serve two masters. You need to help along those at the younger stage, but also clearly the senior athletes and clearly the people already representing Ireland are also in need of this funding. Like, there's talk about the O'Donovan's racing yesterday and racing the Olympics in a four-year-old boat.
Yeah. I mean, and like, they had to pay part of their way to an event earlier this year as well.
And so people might scoff at the idea that they, you know, are rowing in a four-year-old boat. There is talk that they were losing time. When you see as well, Dennis Walsh has a piece in the Sunday Times talking about the work that the O'Donovans have put in to get here. We're kind of waiting for the World Championships all year. So, Paul, we went down to Australia and New Zealand, and we knew that that kind of gave us a big boost of fitness and endurance. We could see it in the lab tests and the ergometer tests. We were setting PBs on all those all along, and we were waiting for it to come together in the boat, and that was the best set of strokes we've ever put together. Now, call me, I don't know, a bit old-fashioned and maybe out of touch with things, but I don't imagine lab tests and ergometer tests in New Zealand and Australia come cheap.
No.
I wouldn't imagine so. And the thing is that the success at the top level is what gets the 6 and 7 and 8-year-olds of the country interested in a sport, and maybe when they get into their teenage years and they're thinking of dropping out of the sport, it's a lot of the time it's what convinces them to persevere. So, you know, it's not just, you know, a medal grab or anything like that, or, you know, a cash splash to make the nation feel good about itself competing on an international level. Supporting these athletes does play a part in the grassroots development of the sport as well. There's no denying that. And it seems to me kind of backwards to not give our top athletes the financial support that they deserve to go and compete, because otherwise the whole development, the whole rationale behind developing them to that level is, it seems, kind of wasted.
The point we were making earlier, these could be seen obviously as minority sports, but they're sports that we've been successful in. It's like, as you mentioned earlier on, before we came on, about golf, if you win a major, that gets you your
automatic qualification for whatever, yeah.
And this just seems like just a severe lack of cop on.
In Ireland, like,
I know, but it's just basic stuff. Like, if you win medals at the Olympics, in the next funding cycle, you should be getting the money you need to be able to progress further. These athletes are still involved. Like, it's just,
and people listening to this might be kind of scoffing and furrowing their brow, thinking, "Oh, like, you know, you can't necessarily just have handouts just for the sake of it." Just put it into context. Colin Cole's piece here says, "Rowing Ireland had received €90,000 of the €175,000 it had sought." Now, €175,000 in the grand scheme of things is not huge money. And again, he talks about Sailing Ireland got less than half of the €349,000 capital funding it had wanted for boats, vans and other equipment, along with the €160,000 grant. It did get €40,000 to set up a training camp in Tokyo, which is at least something.
Mm. But we're talking about boats and vans here, the fundamentals of being able to compete with the world's best, which is what we're asking these people to do. Like, we're not talking about, you know, personal chefs or, you know, 3-month-long training camps elsewhere. We're talking about boats and vans, capital.
Trailers as well. Yeah. Let's not forget the trailers.
You mentioned about handouts, but like, these athletes, they've deserved it. Like, they've actually gone out and been successful at the very, very top of their sport.
On behalf of the country,
you know? Yeah. I don't know. It's just baffling, really.
Yeah, I'd imagine this is going to be a subject we're going to review over and over again over the course of the next 18
months. Look forward to hearing Shane Ross's thoughts on it.
He sends his congratulations, I'm sure. He sends his congratulations. Lots of pieces knocking around today, as we kind of figured there would be, on Kieran Donaghy, who this week announces his inter-county retirement. Where do we want to start, Niall? There's about 3 or 4 of them knocking around that are actually really, really good.
There's a few very interesting ones. I think the three that stand out are Mark O'Shea, former teammate of Kieran Donaghy in the Mail. Then you have Joe Brawley in the Sunday Independent, and you have Christy O'Connor in the Sunday Times. I think, for me, they all do slightly different things, which is brilliant, because it means that you can read all three of them and take something
clash,
different.
Yeah, yeah.
No, you can take something different away from all of them, but I think Mark O'Shea's, for me, is a lovely, lovely piece, because it gives a sense of, there's a lot being said this week about Kieran Donaghy and his transformative impact as a footballer and what he has done to transform the game, and to how he has been such a key presence for Kerry football for the last 12 years. Mark O'Shea kind of takes us a little bit in behind the dressing room door and gives us another side of Kieran Donaghy again.
I'm shocked to discover that Kieran Donaghy was something of a messer and a bit of a cad.
But even the first, Mark O'Shea's opening paragraph, he walked into our lives straight out of a comic strip. "The first time I ever set eyes on Kieran Donaghy was in a county league match with Austin Stacks in 2004, and I paid no heed. The second time I saw him was a year later when he's stepping out of this banged up blue Opel Astra outside Fitzgerald Stadium as he joined us for Kerry training. There was something almost comical at seeing this terror of human flesh and bone being poured out of what he made look like a dinky car. It may as well have been Mr. Bean's Mini, because I remember thinking he could do with a can opener to rip off the roof rather than having to squeeze his giant frame through that door. And like, I think it really gets us straight to the heart of what Kieran Donoghue was. He was this giant personality, this giant influence, but again, like he was a real character of Gaelic football and has been for the last 12 years. And some of the stories, you were picking out a few of them earlier, David, like some of the stories that Mark tells about Donoghue in the dressing room and the relationship that those teammates had.
Yeah, like obviously I wouldn't be like a big GAA man, and then if you're looking at Kieran Donoghue from the outside, you just see this big lump of a brute and you're sort of thinking what sort of character he is. But I actually really enjoyed Mark O'Shea's piece in the Mail, just because, like as Niall mentioned earlier, the three different pieces that are on him, but this one, because it's a teammate and you sort of get in behind a little bit and you sort of see the character he was, and it finishes off, it makes it clear that this could be someone who will be a future Kerry manager. But even more so with Mark, when he was talking about when he was going through his own struggles and he was thinking he's finished, he's gonna pack it in. And
he did his best to convince him to stay
on. He got in touch with him and said, right, I'm collecting you, we're going to drive the train. And then he kind of poured his heart out to him, really, and told him what he meant to him and all the rest of it. And it's just one of the few anecdotes that are in Mark O'Shea's piece that anyone who is a kind of a GA in person or a Kerry supporter or whatever is going to just find really interesting, and kind of just some good kind of Paul Gascoigne-esque
to say you had to be a strong character, as you mentioned the Gascoigne analogies, you had to be a strong character to survive the Kerry dressing room scenes. One summer, Mark writes, long after he had ditched the Astra for a machine easier on the eye and his headspace, I put fish guts into a plastic bag, squeezed it up into a crevice under the passenger seat. That was one hot smelly week, says Mark. I'd wait for his arrival in the dressing room where I had a receptive audience. Star, I wouldn't want to be getting too personal, but you could nearly do with a shower before training. He was going off the head when he discovered the source of the scent. I spent the rest of the year hiding my car keys. I bloody well say you did, Mark O'Shea. He will be coming after you.
Mark's piece is probably the main one of the three that touches on Donoghue's kind of tactical nous and this kind of how he liked to draw. I mean, it's something we see more and more in Gaelic football with the kind of the basketball influence, and Donoghue obviously magnificent basketball player as well, but had a real passion, as Mark is saying, for American sports and soccer, and would use those kind of tactical insights and tactical thinking, a real kind of cerebral approach to the game himself, that he was able to, he was always looking for the 1% to pick up from everything else that was going on around him. It wasn't just this physical wrecking ball that people maybe sometimes suspect. You know, the big man on the edge of the square sometimes gets an unfair reputation, but a lot more to him than that.
It's something that Christy O'Connor touches on in his piece as well, because he talks about the clones and he interviews one of them that came after Donoghue, one being Michael Cusson for Cork. But the prophetic nature of Jack O'Connor in 2006, speaking about Donoghue, saying if he stays healthy and keeps his feet in the ground, Donoghue will transform Gaelic football, said O'Connor in October 2006. Again, of all the tactics in the world, but with his hands and athleticism, he'll be very hard to stop. Gaelic football will constantly change, and other counties will now be out to find their Donoghues. And indeed they were, but it was his ability to change and his ability to adapt, because the game has changed immeasurably in the intervening 12 years that Donoghue made his debut.
The sweeper and stuff like that.
Yeah, like the sweeper and brought in blanket defences. There's different ways to break stuff down. But you always figured, and we even saw it this year, that Donoghue would find a way to be able to do it. And you think of David Clifford's goal this year as well. What did that come from?
And that saved. Yeah. Like, if had Kerry lost that game against Monaghan, that was it. The championship was over at that point. And it was, Joe Bradley, I think, captures the essence of it in his piece, which kind of is a superb piece for encapsulating the Kieran Donoghue show.
Yeah. In his piece, Mark O'Shea mentions Donoghue in terms of being straight out of a comic book. But Brawley's opening paragraph is absolutely superb, has to be said, without wanting to give Joe Brawley an even bigger head than he probably already has. When Kieran Donoghue strode into the square for the big game, they should have had Michael Buffer announcing his arrival. In the green and gold corner, standing 6'5" in height, weighing in at 60.5 stone, Christ, with a heavyweight championship record of 13 goals and 32 points, an incredible 41 goal assists, and 103 points, the Tralee Terror, Kieran, the star,
Donaghy, no full forward in history, says Joe, in history, has brought such excitement and drama to his position. He didn't go so much to the square as climb into the ring. Yeah. Just gorgeous stuff.
Later in that piece, he describes him as Gaelic football's first fairground attraction. And while that might overstate things a little bit, it does, like, the entire sense
of... the bearded lady.
The entire sense of Brawley's piece kind of captures the excitement and just the sheer unpredictability of having Kieran Donaghy on the edge of the square in any game will bring. And I remember I was saying to you outside, I remember the 2015 All-Ireland final, Dublin against Kerry, which is a distant memory now in terms of what's come since, like, you know. And but you forget, like, in the wind and the rain that day, it was a manky day, and you forget how close Dublin came to not even winning the first of that four in a row. Because late on, the ball on the edge of the square drops in, and Kieran Donaghy, just, you could feel the air nearly from both sets of fans suck out of Croke Park that day in just anticipation of what could or might happen. As Kieran Donaghy went up, won the ball, and palmed it off to Killian Young. And for a split second, there was only 3 points in it at that stage. For a split second, the first of those four Dublin All-Irelands was gone. Only for Killian Young just couldn't quite make it count. But that was that unpredictability, and Donaghy says it himself, like has said it himself a few times and said it again this week, that sheer unpredictability, it might not be the prettiest way of playing football, that direct ball to the edge of the square, but even 2 weeks ago in the All-Ireland final, like you saw Dublin struggle to deal with it again when Cullen Kavanagh went in on the edge of the square. There is a beauty in the sheer chaos that a man of Donaghy's talent can bring.
It's interesting as well, Tony, but just obviously what you're talking there about the kind of the chaos and the unpredictability, but in Mark O'Shea's piece, and it's a kind of a good kind of indication of just the kind of character he is. So he says, he made himself into the player he was. This star wasn't born. He was manufactured out of pure desire. That attitude never left him. He was dropped for the 2013 Munster final, was a bit part player for most of the 24 championship before he went and won it for us, and then was dropped when he was captain in the 2015 final. Never once did he let his personal disappointment sour our dressing room. So it just shows you, this is like, for all what he's achieved, he's not precious.
No.
Like, there's maybe other people would have their nose put out a joint to me, like, you know what, I've done me bit, I'm off. Like, even after all that, he's stuck with it, and it's that kind of mix bit. He's kind of brings that unpredictability, but in the dressing room, you knew what you were going to get from him.
There was a reason why fans of the other 31 counties did not like Kieran Donaghy.
Because he was good.
Yeah, because and it was all fear. It was pure fear. And he was the kind of player that you would
do your damage, like.
Love in your team, but they hated him because they were afraid of him.
They're afraid of him, and he's also he was a big personality, and still is obviously, who could back it up.
Yeah,
like, that's a hell of a combo to mix.
And Brawley touches on that. He talks about that 2006 season, and after Donaghy obviously was introduced against Longford, and the day the star was born, as it subsequently has now been, the quarter final Kerry against Armagh. And he said, not only did Donaghy, he describes that moment where Donaghy scored and then immediately got in the face of Paul Hearty, the Armagh goalkeeper. And he said it was that as much as anything else. This Armagh team were known for being in your face, for winning that psychological warfare. And Donaghy, not only did he drive a dagger into them with the goal, but then got in Hearty's face and was like, we are not going to be... you're not going to push us around. This is not your day anymore.
Yeah.
And that became just as vital a part of his personality and his what he brought to the team over the years.
That battle with Francie Bellew that day as well, he's played there brilliantly, but brilliant his piece. Kieran played the game with honour. He loved the contest and the drama, and he never shirked his responsibility, says Brawley. No hiding around the middle third for him, taking an easy pass and hand passing it off. Seems like he might be having a dig at somebody there. when he was on the square, it was as though there was a giant thought bubble above him saying, bring it on. For 12 years, he was Kerry's symbol of resistance. There, fuck you to others. Now the mantle passes to young David Clifford. No pressure there, David.
Yeah, Joe manages to insert himself into the end of that piece as well. We could leave that for people who pick up the scene to themselves.
That paragraph is purely for Joe and for his own pleasure there. But it is a mark of Donaghy's... mark in the game, I guess. Back to Christie's piece in the Times, saying basically the new playing rules committee which have met five times, are discussing a new vision. A number of potential rule changes are up for discussion, one of which is a mark inside the 20-metre line. It would mean a radical change, but it would be at least encouraging more long kicks and high catching and more contests. The GEA, it seems, want more Donaghy's.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to be said for more Donaghy's. I'm not sure that Donaghy by rule is the way to go, myself personally.
Writing Donaghy into the actual laws of the game is not right.
I don't think so. I think the beauty of Kieran Donaghy is when they come, not everybody has one, and not everybody has the capability of playing that way, and not everybody, certainly not everybody, has the talent to execute that tactic to the standard that Kieran Donaghy did. So I wouldn't be a mad fan of Donaghy by rule now.
We will leave the Donaghy pieces there. Literally, they're all worth reading. Mark O'Shea in the Mail, Christy O'Connor in the Times, and then on to Brawley as well with that opening. Fantastic couple of paragraphs. In the Sunday Independent Sports section, sticking with the Sin, though, Stephen Hunt leading the trail of pieces about Roy and Harry Arter and Ireland as a whole this week, because it's still very much in the conversation. And I guess it will be because Stephen's on commentary today for those of us who are listening to us live. He'll be joining us later at Molyneux for Wolves and Burnley. Can't imagine there'd be any Irish interest there. If the Irish assistant manager spoke to me the way Roy Keane is alleged to have spoken to Harry Arter, there is absolutely no way it would stop me from playing for my country. If anything, it would inspire me to prove him wrong, and I would be happy to keep coming back for more, writes Stephen Hunt.
Yeah, I think just dealing with Stephen Hunt's column itself, it comes down to a kind of question of attitudes. I would imagine the majority of footballers and people involved in football, or even any sport, would share Stephen Hunt's opinion that, yeah, if a manager, or the assistant manager in this case, has a go at you, no matter what he says, you don't, not so much try your toys out of the pram, but you stick at it and you kind of take it on the chin and try and prove him wrong. Then you go slightly inside on the Sindo with Eamon Sweeney, and even so with a couple of other columnists, and it's very much a different view, that it's totally unacceptable, that it's disgraceful what Keane said. And it is, in fairness, what Keane said was bang out of order, and he should apologise. But it comes down to a kind of a case of attitudes to this, and is it so much the onset of bullying, or to use that word, or is this something that is just part and parcel of a camp? It's an interesting one. Like, you look in the front of the Sunday Times as well, and even in a couple of other papers, the Matt Doherty interview, and he makes it plain that this isn't a common occurrence within the Ireland camp, where Keane will behave as he did in this instance. It seems to have been a bit of a one-off. Whether or not you can make allowances for that, I'm not quite sure. But it's an interesting one. I think it's worth reading Stephen's view on it, to kind of see the professional's point of view of inside the kind of the dressing room and how players would feel. Richard Dunn said stuff very similar during the week, that you're playing for your country, you're not playing for the manager, you're not playing for the assistant manager, you're playing for your country. But there is that other element as well, by just purely the language that was used and the manner of it as well. It wasn't sort of just maybe you kind of on the training ground and sort of language can be used. This was something that Keane kind of sought him out and made a point of chasing down a corridor,
I think that's the issue with it.
That's the issue, yeah.
If Stephen Ward, God bless him on his WhatsApp, is to be believed, Keane sought out Arter, who was receiving treatment, and this was the second time that they had come to at least a verbal altercation, which seems to be one-sided, because Arter was sitting back, and was probably politically the best way of going about this is to sit there and just let Roy be Roy.
Because he had to go out Walters as well.
Walters as well on the sideline, the training pitch, and then later on in the week in the training, or in the treatment room, he seeks him out, and the language of it, I can take or leave. Like, robust language happens everywhere. It's the nature of questioning his authority, or not authority, authenticity of his injury. Like, that for me, like, an assistant manager should trust his medical team and should trust the player.
Go back to Saipan. Keane, one of the main
sticking points. We're not saying that word
around here anymore. But this is why it's so interesting. And it just sums up Roy Keane, because it's just kind of not so much hypocrisy. Like, he's just, in any given day, you never know what you're going to get, probably. But, like, that's like a serious accusation to make if he's saying about his injuries, you know. But, like, with Stephen Hunt, one of the paragraphs, which was interesting, where he says, "I'm surprised Arter hasn't just thought, I can't believe what Roy Keane said to me. but he can say what he wants and he might not rate me, but it's not going to stop me wearing that jersey. If you have the chance to represent your country, it doesn't matter if you dislike the manager or the staff. You might hate them with a passion, but you're still torn up.
That reminded me of the Manchester City documentary. The guys, if you hate me, guys, I don't care, guys. You know, just use that and use it on the pitch, guys.
But it's using it in the right way, country.
Yeah, and the hypocrisy element, like, I thought it was interesting that over the last maybe 10 days, that extract from Roy's second book has started to do the rounds again. Him talking about Ruud van Nistelrooy and Van Nistelrooy kind of being happy if he had any sort of a niggle or any sort of a twinge or a complaint, that Ruud was like, well, I need to look after myself. This is one weekend out of a 20-year career and I'm going to do what's right by me. And in doing what's right by me, I'm doing what's right by the team as well. Mm. And Roy, obviously, as a player, and he did. There were a lot of occasions throughout his international career where he wasn't present for Ireland duty because he stayed at his club for treatment. Mm. But it was only in the book, he says himself that he admits that, you know, he was wrong sometimes to play when injured for United, and he wishes he had been a little bit more like Van Nistelrooy, which is at complete odds with what we're seeing here now.
I mean, like, it's actually pointless to try and get into the head of Roy Keane and talk about the rights and wrongs of this and go through everything. Like, it's crazy stuff what's been happening, but that's just been Roy Keane for his whole career. It really is. Like, the way you have to look at this now from an Ireland point of view is Martin O'Neill is the manager. So he came out and took responsibility and said, Roy Keane is my responsibility. But now, like, O'Neill, this is going to be, I go as far as say, make or break for him in terms of what happens now for the rest of his tenure. Like, he's got so much grief and stick for being almost like a dinosaur in terms of the tactics. People say he doesn't spend enough time training, doesn't do this, doesn't do that. But everyone who works with him says it's his ability to be able to mould a group together, his man management. This is going to be now where O'Neill, we're going to see why O'Neill is paid so much money and if he still has that spark and that kind of ability to be able to do this. He's got meetings coming up now this week with Arthur, with Rice, with Stephen Ward, and Keane will be involved with that as well, to try and get this all sorted. Like, we've got games next month. This can fester. It's not allowed to fester. Like, Keane is going to be involved. He's not going to get sacked, right? He's going to be a part of this group, and there might be another instance again where Keane will, of course they will. He's not going to be able to just be timid, but this is where O'Neill now has to take control of the situation. And for all the criticism he's got, rightfully, in terms of people saying he names the team an hour before kickoff, he doesn't do enough preparation, but it's all the stuff now. This is where we'll find out if O'Neill is still the manager he was 10-15 years ago. He's proven it in the last couple of years, got us to the Euros. Obviously we got a hiding in the World Cup playoff, but up until that second leg, done very well as well. So, but this now is going to be a crucial period, but it's going to be O'Neill now has to take, really does have to take control of this.
Does Arthur have another point of agreement in the last week or so, whereby any time his name is brought up to Martin O'Neill, who's supposed to be taking charge of the situation, taking responsibility for it, I don't want to say he's thrown Arthur under the bus, but he said, well, you want to go and talk to Harry about his issues around this and why he's not here, and I suppose... hinting towards him speaking to certain elements of the press and putting his side of things out there, whereby the Ireland and Roy Keane wasn't put out there. Like, Arthur has not necessarily been hung out to dry, but he hasn't necessarily been helped and made feel welcome, I imagine, by the Irish manager. Well, as a whole,
yeah. Like, but just in think it's Colin Young has it in today's front page of the sports section of the Sindo that he's going to be meeting with Harry Arthur. Like, it's difficult as well. It was in the middle of camp, so like, unless he was going to break away from that and meet, and then maybe that would have been a kind of a show of support, I don't know. But I don't know, like,
he's down the road. It wasn't as if you're like looking to jet him into the west coast of America. Like, they were playing in Cardiff. Yeah. He plays in Cardiff. He lives 10 minutes.
The way I look at it here then as well is if O'Neill really, really, really wanted to make that sort of effort with him and touch, you know what? He actually even said it himself that like Rice would have been certain to play, maybe not so much Arthur. He started thinking, well, do you know what? I can maybe do without you, and he doesn't want the hassle. Then that could be O'Neill's way of thinking with it. I don't know. I don't think we're in
the
position.
They can't.
I don't think we're in it. Looking from the, like, if you're looking at it as an Irish fan, they're not in the position to say we don't want the Premier League midfielder in our squad.
He goes on to have a good 6 months now for Cardiff, and he's left ostracised by Ireland purely on the basis of well, he wouldn't have gotten the team 6 months ago.
This is where you have to be pragmatic about it as well. Yeah. Like, O'Neill might have his opinions of him as a player. And obviously Roy clearly does. But this is where O'Neill just has to get him back on side. like, he has to have a clear, first of all, it has to be Roy Keane has to do this as well. Like, O'Neill can only go so far.
Oh, I'd kill to be part of those meetings.
I'd
absolutely kill to be part
of those meetings. I'm not sure how Keane can come back from this, really, other than he says, listen, I was out of order.
He's not going to.
What he said, allegedly, and if obviously what it says is true, and how he said it, and it's pretty ruthless stuff, like, you know. And but just going back to, he just obviously, this is a paper review, like Kevin Moore in the Sunday World makes a point, say a couple of days ago he was talking to a friend of Alex Ferguson's, and Ferguson, this was before Ferguson had his kind of health issues, said back in the day, this was Ferguson talking to his friend, back in the day you could demand of footballers, nowadays you have to convince them. And that in a nutshell, this is what Kevin Moore is saying, that in a nutshell is where Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane seem to have gone wrong. So that comes back to it as well, is already a bit out of touch of what the modern player.
Gary Breen said something pretty similar last Sunday with us as well. He was like, don't tell us, like, again, point towards him saying that Arthur maybe wouldn't have been in the starting 11, but Gary was on with us last week saying, don't tell us how limited we are. Yes. Coach us well and tell us how good we could be. And that seems to be something that's lacking from this management team as a unit.
The last 9 months, just pure and simple, have not been kind to Roy Keane and his managerial prospects. I mean, if you wind it back to the start of the year, to January, when it looked like Martin O'Neill was dead set for Stoke, you probably would have found it quite difficult to find a significant dissenting voice, or certainly you would have found significant support on the other side for, well, okay, well, if O'Neill goes to Stoke, then let Roy have it. The job is Roy's. Now, I think, given everything that's happened in the intervening period, it's very difficult to see how Roy Keane will be the Ireland manager if and when Martin O'Neill leaves. Mm. And on top of that, as David says, and it's a point that Ewan McKenna touched on in his column in the Sunday Business Post as well, it's hard to see really where Roy Keane fits in the current managerial landscape. I mean, he obviously still has designs to manage at the top level, but his personality seems, and his managerial style, and not his way of thinking about the game, his way of reading the game, like, I think is well established, and, you know, there's no denying what he did. Well, it's 10 years ago now when he was at Sunderland. Mm. But his management style and his personality seem completely at odds with certainly what most top managers in the game bring now, which is a much more... It's the headline on Moran's piece there, I'm just reading over David Schroeder, is agony and not sergeant majors needed. And if, when you kind of look at the certainly outwardly facing with the managers like Klopp and Guardiola, it is very much more arm around the shoulder rather than kick up the arse. And
it's the mix. It has to be, like, I know you're saying that about the arm around the shoulder, but like Klopp and Guardiola would be ruthless when they have to be, but they do it in the right way. Like, just if you're a chairman of a club in England and you're saying this about Roy Keane, you're just thinking, nah, it's not worth the hassle. But isn't, like, if you look at him on ITV, that's what he's suited. That's actually what he's suited perfectly to now.
He's a footballing one-man Statler and Waldorf. Yeah. He is, though. And it's a role that he's created for himself, in that he wants to sit there and put out snarky jibes about the current Liverpool side or the current Manchester United side or Tottenham in the Champions League qualifiers as a highlights package on ITV. And that will be used as a 10-15 second clip on Twitter the next day. And he'll sit back, won't pretend he won't see it, pretend he won't look at it, but he's delighted that he's made his impact on the world.
Yeah, well, he's only able to say all that because no Irish player actually plays for those clubs anymore, which is, that's the bigger problem in all of this, is it's just feeding into, following on from, obviously, the World Cup playoff to Denmark and all this. This is just the last thing that was needed. This Nations League should have started off with kind of for the future, looking to the future and kind of hopefully seeing some promising signs. But then you even see Matt Doherty kind of talking about how his face doesn't fit and stuff, and it feels like the beginning of the end, really, that this is going to be, unless, as I said earlier, O'Neill shows his class again and pulls us out of the bag. But it does begin, look, now this is the beginning of the end, and that as the months go on, it'll just kind of peter out to God knows what.
Acrimony and rancour. You touched on Mark Doherty there. He features in both the Sunday Independent and the Times today, because Colin Young and Paul Rowan sat down with the Wolves full back. Hmm. I'd imagine Martin O'Neill's probably not the happiest of chappies reading either of these interviews, because there's a couple of little sly digs in there, it seems, from the outside looking in anyway. He was asked, it basically starts in Paul Rowan's piece anyway, talking about a practical joke that they played on the Wolves manager Nuno Espirito Santo while on the golf course. in Marbella of last year. He's given a duff ball which explodes once he strikes with the driver, and white powder blows into his clothes and on his face. I'd imagine O'Neill and Keane would be apoplectic at that. But then Doherty says, in perhaps the most killer line, when speaking about management at least, he's definitely one the best coach that I've worked with, 100%. He's out on the training pitch every day. Some managers might be just on the sidelines, but he takes every session. Some managers that we've had here before wouldn't even go out to watch that session. There, he's obviously speaking about previous Wolves managers. But yeah, from what we hear about Ireland sessions...
You could take the logical conclusion that maybe it's a bit of a sly dig. I know from being involved, that was probably like a Sunday's brief, and so there would have been maybe, could have been 6 or 7 journalists. You never know. That could have been totally separate of when it was said. But yeah, it's a logical kind of conclusion to make. The more damning stuff would be in there about... I think Noel mentioned it earlier about he scored an own goal. What was he scored an own goal?
Yeah, he scored an own goal against Leicester. And when he came into camp, it's dealt with in more length in Colin Young's piece. And Doherty says, the things that were going through my head after that game were not good. It was one of the worst things ever. It couldn't have hit my head any cleaner, and it went in the top corner. And then he moves on to say, the weekend could have been so different. I looked at my phone afterwards and it was carnage. When I went away with Ireland, a few of the boys brought it up. It's usually people outside the club. I can't remember who it was, but someone brought it up way too soon, straight after it happened. I didn't like that one little bit. Someone said, good goal, and that wasn't nice. Yeah.
That just sounds a bit precious, to be honest.
That's a bit like...
Cut yourself on.
Even at the end of the game, somebody in the Wolves camp, you would imagine, would have made a joke of it, and you probably would have gotten over it. To go into the Ireland camp and expect to have to start at zero again, and I don't know.
Everybody on eggshells.
Yeah, I suppose it depends who said it, I suppose, as well. Yeah. It could be somebody who doesn't like or whatever, but just another little kind of chink, isn't it?
And he mentions as well that obviously Matt Doherty likes wearing gloves when he plays football, and he mentions that Martin O'Neill has had a quiet word. Now, it's kind of brushed over a little bit in the piece that... you know, he says that Martin O'Neill has raised it with him, but more jokingly. But it all kind of feeds into, like, when you add all of these small little elements up, it does build into a bigger picture that maybe is slightly more telling.
With the pieces on Mark Doherty's day, there is a definite piecing together, as you mentioned, in the jigsaw sense of what the O'Neill managerial reign is like. Like, even in Stephen Hunt's piece, he talks about Matt Doherty as well. He was saying he was surprised they didn't start, particularly against Poland. He says, if you're looking for a player to play out of his skin in training, then that's not Doc. But I played alongside him, and he performs in games, and he's arguably our best natural defender. And then on top of that as well, Doherty speaks, this is from Rowan's piece, it gets to the nub of one of the issues with Ireland. Doherty's memory isn't faulty when he says that O'Neill initially complained about his defending at the back post from set pieces, but also about his fitness levels. Doherty feels he's corrected both, and after the Poland friendly last week, when Doherty replaced Cyrus Christie in the 54th minute, O'Neill embarked on a lengthy critique about Doherty's offensive play, saying he wanted him to run at his opponents more and try and get crosses in from the byline like Seamus and Christie. He obviously came out and said he wanted me to attack more, says Doherty, but I'm so used to the way we play here at Wolves. Sometimes we keep going around and eventually create the space to get in, says Doherty. That's his opinion when he watches me. I would say that I maybe don't have the same opinion. Now,
it's interesting.
Stylistically, it shows you the difference where the Republic of Ireland are at.
But that's up to Doherty. Doherty's the one there who has to adapt. Like, he's coming in, and that's how Ireland play. Like, it's interesting stuff. What I would say is it'd have a bit more kind of credence if he wasn't behind Seamus Coleman. You know what I mean? If this is a fella who was a centre midfielder, crying out for him. Like, he's a good player. To quote Eamon Duffy, he's not a great player.
Careful,
you know. But what I mean, like, this just likes me of someone with a bit of a bigger ego. You know, he's a Premier League player now, and he's going to have his first full season. He's clearly got something about himself because he was best right back in the Championship last season. Mm-hmm. Like, Wolves have got a few bob behind them, and their manager, who brought in half of Portugal, but
he wasn't the manager, it was George.
But he's still kept his place. He clearly is a good player. I do have sympathy with him. I do think he should have started in Poland ahead of Cyrus Christie. But if it goes back to this about his training, like, that's where O'Neill, as much as it is with the team, but O'Neill will probably judge him a lot on what he does in training. And if he's half arsed and he's kind of doing what he does at this club, O'Neill will say, well, do you know what? Not for me. Like, Christie adapts to, well, not adapts because he kind of, that's what O'Neill wants, that's his game. You know what I mean? So, like, you have to, like, the manager is the one who picks a team. At the moment, like, you can criticise him because the results aren't going well. That's why you can criticise O'Neill. I'm sure now, if Doherty has a strong month and they're playing Burnley, is it Burnley they're playing today?
Yeah, Burnley. Live and off the ball, David.
Live and off the ball. So, what you call it. So, that's where this season, he can only get in really by just having an absolute stormer of a season. And also, he has to adapt. He can't just... You have to be able
This is how we play at Wolves, and this is what I'm going to
do. Yeah, it's not going to cut it, like. And Ireland play a totally different game.
But you can sense his frustration in that there is a bit more of a canny nature to the way Wolves would play football.
But that's not how Ireland play, you know? So, tough me, like, you know what I mean?
Snade for Ireland manager.
Yeah. At the moment, O'Neill.
Nice little tidbit in it, though, saying a home farm where he obviously started off and then came via Bowes. There's a board where your name gets put on it if you get capped for Ireland. I remember my dad saying, if you get a cap, I'm going to come in here and make sure your name is put on it. It's actually in the process of getting done, so it's a nice thing for him. Now, we spoke about it and it happened. So Matt Doherty there features in both the broadsheets today with Colin Young and Paul Rowan. Another man who features in two papers today, and possibly even more, Wayne Rooney.
Yeah.
You sat down with both Jonathan Northcroft and Ollie Holt. Northcroft is in the Times. Holt is in, of course, your paper, David, the Mail on Sunday.
Yeah,
loads of interesting bits in this.
Yeah, there actually is. It's very good. In fairness, with Rooney, when he does these sort of pieces, he can be very good. You know, it does strike me as maybe this is a kind of a Paul Streffer job. Get the two lads over and kind of do a piece on the rebranding of Wayne Rooney in America. You know,
Wayne Rooney, normal bloke.
I know, but
well,
look at him. Even there, he's wearing a kind of a shirt that you probably get at Marks and Spencer's and a kind of jeans with his belt tucked in. He looks like
I can guarantee you that shirt didn't come from Marks and Spencer's.
I know, yeah, but it looks like it. There is loads in it. Basically, the gist of it in both pieces is Rooney is kind of the everyman now in America. He's able to go to the shops and buy his son Fortnite. He walked for 18 miles around Washington, not a bother on him. Was able to, and he's just loving life. There's a great line in it, though, when he does say, "I'm able to reintegrate into society," which is quite telling.
It is.
You think about it, he
mentions there, you talk about that excursion saying, I picked up my kids from school yesterday and took them to the shopping mall. He's already saying mall, which is a worry. And there was no bother. I promised Kai a computer to play Fortnite on. God help him when they start flossing. Then we went bowling into the cinema in England. I had to plan and make sure that everyone was right before we went. And you can imagine that's absolutely true. And it's this weird, and you don't want to feel sorry for somebody who's been pulling in 250 grand a week over the course of the past few years.
But the trade-off of a normal life, isn't
that
it?
That does, yeah, absolutely. Your life has just gone to pot on that front.
And the next line from, which is Northcroft rather than a Rooney quote, is actually really instructive, which is, he can be a better dad here. Yeah. And there is, that kind of often gets forgotten in the mix and in all the hype. I mean, Wayne Rooney, superstar, has been since he's been a teenager, living his life in the public glare, that there is a family and there are young children and all involved in this. And that sometimes that's what... realistically what he will want to be. He doesn't always want to be the man with the number on his back and the captain's arm, and sometimes he just wants to be a father to his kids and wants the space to do it. And I think that's pretty understandable. Or maybe I'm just getting suckered in by a PR job here.
To be honest, it does sort of strike you that way a little bit, that it's clear that, but at the same time, he's being honest about stuff as well. And I didn't read the full Northcroft one. I read it in Ollie Holt's piece. But in fairness, Ollie Holt touched on it at the end about, obviously, part of the reason he was in trouble in England, the drink driving charge, when he got done, he's in the middle of a 2-year ban, so he has a driver in Washington at the moment. But he was saying how part of his community service when he was in Macclesfield was working in a garden centre with people who have learning disabilities. And so he spent time with them and was doing stuff, but he stayed in touch. And they're sending him videos of some of the people involved, like dancing videos and stuff. And kind of when he comes back, he goes over to them and spends time with them. And that's near the end. And that comes across as genuine. It doesn't come across as kind of really trying to say, I'm totally changed and all this. And it just comes across as someone who kind of genuinely seemed to have had a kind of a nice experience in kind of doing that community service, and at least kind of seems to have had the benefit of it, of actually, just actually having a nice experience with those people.
You'd imagine this is the Wayne Rooney now that he always wanted to be. I mean, he broke through at 16 into the first team at Everton with that goal against Arsenal, etc. And he just wants to be a normal bloke playing football, and just happens to get caught up in the celebrity of it all over the course of the past decade.
It certainly seems like that. And I think in Jonathan Northcroft's piece, he actually opens with an anecdote about when Rooney first arrived in Washington. The first team were away somewhere, so he ended up taking a training session with the academy. And maybe, you know, this is just, you know, the first day kind of thing, you set your stall out. But after the training session and driving the intensity standards of the training session, he was the one that went around picking up the cones then afterwards. And Jonathan Norcroft just kind of says that, you know, the Americans are learning what was not always understood at home, that the crux of Rooney's talent is team focus. And yes, he is an outstanding individual talent, or it certainly was an outstanding individual talent at the peak of his powers. But quite often, you know, was as good a player for the way he managed to integrate the others around him.
Yeah, they mentioned this, how he's brought along young Luciano Acosta at DC United. Stephen Goffrey writes for the Washington Post, saying he's endeared himself to fans not just because he scores, because he works his ass off, says Goffrey.
No, there's loads in it. Like, it's great, and it's some in-depth stuff, and maybe this is just my shallowness coming out, but my favourite part in it is about Memphis Depay.
This is gold.
And like, just if you're a Man United fan, this just sums up the post Alex Ferguson era. So it's kind of basically, Depay had a stinker against Stoke. He kind of gave away a ball and Stoke scored. So Van Gaal brings him in and says, listen, you're dropped, you're playing with the reserves tonight. Rooney, who was the captain, sort of says, look, it's going to be a bit difficult for you, just don't come in with all your fancy stuff. So then naturally Memphis Depay then turns up in Altrincham in a Rolls Royce wearing a red leather jacket and a cowboy hat and Rooney just says, I thought to myself, what's the point? But Memphis, he's a lovely lad. And like, it's just, that's just one little snippet of a very, very kind of good interview.
Yeah, it's good to see things are going well from now, says Wayne.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great story.
He gives you an insight into the, God, the name Roy Keane gets mentioned here as well. The last two or three years, you go into the dressing room, says Wayne, you see players on FaceTime, which is incredible, really. Compare that to when I started and all the phones were turned off before you get into the coaching out of the stadium. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, just it's a change in society, a change in the way the world is going. Players on FaceTime. Roy Keane, he says. Imagine what Roy would do.
Yeah. But that's just like, again, it goes back to Alex Ferguson. Ferguson talks about this all the time, that he thrived off having young people around. That's what helped him kind of, like, Ferguson brought through so many different teams, and that's what helped him be a great manager. And it's the same, like, Rooney's talking about it there. Like, everyone of say, my age around 30 will just remember Rooney. He'd be probably kind of the first superstar, really, at that age in terms of coming in at 16, just being amazing for Man United, England's top goal scorer. But that's what you have to be as a, especially in football, you have to get with the times. And we're going back to, obviously, Keane and stuff. Ferguson was the master at it. He was able to adapt, you know. He saw Cristiano Ronaldo and doing all the step-overs and all the rest of it. But he realised the talent that was there and was able to put up with that for a while, because he saw the hard work that was also going on. And just that's... Rooney hits the nail on the head, though. You have to kind of, like, FaceTime, yeah, it's different, but you have to get with it. Like, you have to kind of, you can't just say, right, that's not for us, we're not having it. Like, you have to kind of, players, as you say, again, from earlier, you have to be able to convince players. And that's one way of doing it, is by showing them that you can get with them. Like.
Get with them, and their red leather coats, and their cowboy hats.
Well, yeah, maybe not that.
I'd imagine there'd be pretty much a dearth of them. Maybe from the Cork end, who knows, today, at Croke Park. 50,000 all expected for the ladies' football final. Incredible numbers that keep ramping up and up and up as years and years go by. It's fantastic to see, and obviously with the wraparound, the Sunday Independent again going big in the ladies' football final today.
Yeah, it's brilliant to see, and I think maybe the most welcome aspect of the whole thing is, I think, the way in which national mainstream media, in print, online, and broadcast, are treating the women's game now, is that this isn't a surprise. Once upon a time, it would have been remarkable to see a wraparound. Now it's nearly unexpected. We have four pages of coverage, plus other articles spread out through the Sunday Independent, and the other papers all have big features as well, looking ahead to Dublin against Cork. And it is, like, it's the marquee fixture in ladies Gaelic football. I know, you know, Galway, Donegal, Mayo will all feel that they were in contention this year. But if you wanted an All-Ireland final that could possibly go and break the attendance record from last year, like, Dublin against Cork was the one it was. The fourth time in 50 years, Dublin have obviously, they have this legacy that they're trying to cast off of defeats against Cork in the most painful circumstances.
Yeah, it's 1-2 points constantly in those three finals before last year.
You know, you had the 2014 final where they were 10 points up and they let it slip away. In the 2016, the Carla Rowe Hawkeye final. I mean, the most heartbreaking circumstances. And then when they did go and win the All-Ireland last year, they managed to do it without having to go through Cork. So this team does know how to beat Cork. They do know how to beat Cork and Croke Park. They did it in the league this year. But
there's points to prove on both sides.
There are points to prove on both sides. I think the Cork side, there's been so much change over the last few years. Yeah. You know, you've obviously all of that stars of the great relentless Cork team, the Breach Corkery, Valerie Mulcahy, Breach Stack. All of those names are gone, and it's a very new, younger, up-and-coming Cork team that have a point of their own to prove. Yeah. But the coverage within the papers today is great. I mean, it's mainly more Dublin-focused than it is Cork-focused. The two big interviews, I know Niamh McAvoy did the Sunday Huddle, so she's across a couple of the papers. Mm. And then Marie Crow went and did something completely different by going to find Alwyn Carey, the Dublin midfielder. And it's lovely because I think on the back of Blues Sisters last year, and as happens with most teams, it's normally the same three or four faces that get put forward as the ones to do media duty, and we read not the same features, but certainly we see the same names. Same names cropping up over and over again.
The profile more so.
Yeah, but Alwyn Carey is someone who doesn't do a lot of media, who hasn't done a lot of media, and her story wouldn't necessarily be known. And Marie gets to the heart of it straight away, because Alwyn Carey, she's 23 now. She never played Gaelic football before she was 11 years old. Dancing was what she did.
Competitive dancing, not just dancing. Mm. Competitive dancing.
But it was 11 years. So 12 years ago, Alwyn Carey had never held a Gaelic football. And now she's starting in, I think, maybe not starting, but certainly featuring in her fourth All-Ireland final. Her fifth All-Ireland final. She has been there through the dark days of all of those defeats to Cork. She hasn't had her chance to kind of avenge that kind of psychological blow that Cork have inflicted on this Dublin team over the years, and today is her day.
We mentioned before about trying to get people, when we were talking about the rowing and sailing and running the show, the participatory nature of trying to get people involved in the sport. I mean, seeing a story like Alwyn Carey's has got to be fantastic for any girls who might have a slight, you know, thinking that they might get involved in sport somehow, yet they might think that even, you know, by 8, 9, 10, 11, that things have maybe passed them by, or the parents are thinking they might have passed them by. Never too late. Absolutely, never too late. 11, getting them in there, she's going to be competing in an All-Ireland final today. It's just remarkable stuff, while also working as a trainee accountant.
Yeah, and
living at home with her mum.
Yeah, the sacrifices come up, and I mean, the sacrifices that are made by top inter-county players, especially in the female game, they are no surprise. But she talks about how this is her first year working full-time. She was in Tala IT last year, and she had it a little bit easier, but you know, she gets a... It was here somewhere. She gets a bus to train and a taxi home or a lift home or whatever way it works. And it just seems, it was something that Mick Bowen touched on in his interviews earlier this week when talking about his top stars, like players who have been around the block for 10, 15 years, and they're getting home from full-time jobs in very demanding professions, and they're getting home from training then at 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night, and they have to sit down and try and make themselves, they try and cook some dinner or make some food to try and, you know, recover properly so that they can get up and go again the next day, all on little to no budget.
Mm-hmm. One of the good lines in Marie's piece there as well is how she's talking about she'd finish training and be going dancing, and she'd be wiping the muck off her legs, which is kind of a funny image.
A great piece as well on the back of that wraparound from Katie Liston, which is talking about the sacrifices players have to make. 2/3 of the county players reported to the WGPA that they did not have consistent access to hot showers after training, and 3/4 had no hot food. Below the surface continues to lie the routine sex segregation and the restricted availability of facilities and resources. And it seems like one of these topics that we always come back around to is, when are the Camogie Association, the LGFA, going to be welcomed into the GA? Is just a wider, it just seems like it should be a natural occurrence, and it should be something that happens, and yet we still have this separation of the women's associations from the GA.
I think there's probably a political aspect there that with in terms of how the associations, what the new structure looks like, and how all of the various positions
having to see decision making duties and all that kind of
all
stuff.
All of the rest of it. I think the appetite for everybody to be under one organised umbrella, like you see it throughout clubs across the country, a lot of GAA clubs have adopted the one club model, and everything within that club, all four codes are all governed under the one club. There's no separation. I think it's very much easier to implement at the micro level of club when you scale it out to national level, and there are people's jobs on the line, there are people's positions of power and prestige and authority on the line. That's where the brakes start to get pumped a little bit, and until
amazing how those things suddenly seem important when the development of the game comes into question. Is that keeping ground? Come here, tell us about the book, because you've been working with our own Andy Lee recently on
fighter?
Yeah, no, we're just about ready. We've just gone to print, so it'll be out in the, I think it's here at the bank holiday weekend in October. Andy will certainly be on to, I hope, to tell you a lot more about the depth and detail. But
well, how do you differ as a subject between him and Philly, for instance?
Yeah, oh, he was, Andy, like, it's probably unfair to compare the two in terms of subjects, but certainly Andy brought a lot of creative ideas to the table. Like, he really engaged with the creative side of how his story could be told and what he wanted to achieve in the telling of the story. Like, he was an open book. Mm. Not more so than Philly was as well, but he was.
But there would have been certain aspects of Philly's modern career, say, that might have been not necessarily off limits, but he would have been more guarded about, say.
Well, I think the whole element of Philly's story and what the story was intended to achieve, and hopefully what it has achieved, was that it was a family story, it was a personal story, and football nearly was tangential. Like, football is obviously the path Philly would tell you himself and happily tell you himself. Football was the path through which he saved himself from going down the same path that his brother John went down. But ultimately, Philly wanted to tell his story in a way that would resonate with the largest amount of people possible, and hopefully affect some sort of social conversation and some sort of change for good. Andy's story is a completely different story. It's fascinating in its own right. For anybody who knows Andy, they know what an Andy Lee book is going to bring to the table. It's very considered and goes into, I hope, answers a lot of the questions that people will have about Andy, his story, and shed some light on some areas of Andy's life that people may not be 100% familiar with away from the headlines. So hopefully...
How long did you do it for? How long
have you been? We've been working on it since the time he retired, around the start of the year. So it comes together very quickly in the end. But I suppose Andy, apart from his obligations in here, since he's retired, you know, he has a few other media obligations, but has been able to dedicate himself completely to the process. So we got through a very large amount in a very short space of time. And
so editing is going to be a pain in the arse then.
Yeah,
more than nothing else.
Yeah, no.
It's trying to take stuff out of Andy's story. Yeah.
It is, and you know, the book realistically probably could have been twice as long as it is if we had gone into the granular detail on every incident. But as it is, the story itself is there, and hopefully people will find it a compelling insight into who I regard as one of the top Irish athletes of the kind of the modern generation.
Don't think there'd be many that disagree. We'll leave the paper review there for now. Noel Kelly, deputy editor of the 42.e, and also ghostwriter of Fighter, the Andy Lee story, and also David Snaid of the Irish Daily Mail and Irish Daily Mail on Sunday. That is the paper review. We'll talk to you next Sunday.
Off the Ball on Newstalk.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products.